Good morning, everybody. We're going to get started in a minute. This morning's talk is an update on HIV. And before we start on that, I want to let everybody know that this will qualify for the state of Florida mandated CME credit for HIV, which applies to the first time you've been licensed. Any of the young doctors that have just gotten their license, you have to have a credit in HIV on for your CME licensure, and that'll qualify for you for until the state changes the law and the rules again. So you'll get a notification from Boca Regional CME Department that your credits have been pushed through to the CE broker. What I'd suggest is when you get that, go online on your CE broker account and double check to make sure that it had been that it's been posted towards the HIV credit. And you'll see it'll be a red flag that'll say whether you need that credit or not. Anyways, so this morning I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Kenneth Poon, who is a specialist in HIV. He's currently the Associate Program Director of Internal Medicine Residency and the Assistant Professor of Clinical Biomedical Science at the FAU Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine. Dr. Poon trained at Jackson Memorial Hospital, did both internal medicine and pediatric residency combined, and he did his infectious disease fellowship at Baylor. He's been actively involved in HIV medicine in Broward County for many years and now has joined the FAU faculty. So it's my pleasure to welcome him.
Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you, everybody, for coming. And I'm going to see if I can operate this clicker. Okay, here we go. All right, so thank you, everybody, for coming, and we're going to kind of go over some of the recent strides in HIV, but primarily, you know, what's the state of our status of HIV here in the U.S.? So just to give you the background, I kind of went over that, but I did... aside from the residency and fellowship, I was active with the HIV Broward Regional Health Planning Council, as well as the Broward Department of Health for about 4 years prior to joining FAU Medical Residency Program and serving as a Associate Program Director, and I have no financial disclosures. Okay, so the overview of the presentation. Today we're going to go over a couple of things, and hopefully nobody will fall asleep, but if so, I'll probably call on you if I know your name. We're going to go over the update of epidemiology of the HIV/AIDS in the U.S., and then we're going to go over some racial ethnic health disparities and where we're uneven in how we treat it in the U.S. We're going to look at it as specifically as our state, and then we're going to look at some of the barriers to the poor adherence to care and the effect of that on their patients. I'm going to give you a brief update on the trends of mortality, you know, what's killing HIV patients nowadays, and then a real brief update on some of the newer treatments and then some of the prevention guidelines if you don't already know them. This is a slide more for the handout because if you get a copy of it, I got to apologize. Number one, as with many speakers, I sent a version that's not complete last week. So if you have the slides, they're not quite, you know, the complete deck. And these abbreviations are going to be helpful for you when you look through the slides. So let's get started. What is the current status of HIV/AIDS epidemic here in the U.S., and how's it changed over time? Well, the best source to get this is from the large CDC HIV surveillance that they do through the NAINS protocol, and they have a database where they take all of the states and county Department of Health, and this is where they get their data to look at exactly what the numbers are. You can freely find these slides on online through the CDC website. So let me see if I have somebody know where the pointer is on this? Well, I'll use the mouse. Okay, so first of all, the estimated number of people living with HIV in the U.S. and the U.S. and Puerto Rico areas is about 1,218,000. So that's a pretty hefty number, and if you break it down, what's striking is that 87% are diagnosed, which means that about 12.8 or 13% are undiagnosed. That's about 1 in 8 or so that don't know that they have HIV. 39% have received medical care of some sort. 36% have been prescribed ARTs, and this is a really embarrassing number for ID and HIV physicians out here. Only 30% of those diagnosed with HIV are virally suppressed, which means that only 30% are treated at the standards that we aim for undetectable viral load so they cannot further spread it. So 12.8% are unaware of their infection. Now, if we break it down to the years, you can see the trend of how we've done. And really, there's not been horribly significant changes in how we've gotten better at controlling this undiagnosed rate. I mean, we're talking about maybe a 2% increase between 2009 and 2012. You're probably asking yourself, this 14 or 15 data up there, and it's about the same. I don't have the slides or the information here for you to look at, but it's about the same. And it's really a horrible number to see that, you know, only 30% are controlled or virally suppressed. Whereas before, it used to be 25.9. That may be a little bit significant, but it's still grossly uncontrolled. And this is why the HIV epidemic, it's going to remain global until we get virally suppressed as treatment for prevention. It's not going to go away. So if we look at those that are linked to care, which means that once they're diagnosed, they have made one appointment and made it to that appointment with their HIV provider. Now, that's all that linkage means. Linkage only means that you make it to your first appointment. So people that link don't necessarily retain in care, which means that they continue to see their physician. Now, if we just look at linkage, the total is about 82%. You know, that means 18% that once they're diagnosed and once they know are not actually going to their very first appointment. That's just one appointment. And this graph breaks it down to the risk factors. So male-to-male sexual contact, the Black and African Americans and Hispanic Latinos. And the reason why this chart brought it out is because these are one of the more significant risk factors for attaining HIV/AIDS. And you can see that they're probably the drivers for such a low number, 82%. Now, the epidemiology slide deck tells us a little more about how it breaks down for, you know, the social dynamic and baseline characteristics of the patients. We all know that males comprise the bulk of the HIV population. They're at most risk for infection. They carry most of the percentage of the infection, and females are at a lower percent. And this is pretty steady through time. We also know that the largest bulk of patients, as far as age distribution, is between the 25 to about 40 years of age. Maybe it's better if I do this. So around the 32% mark is where the bulk of the majority of this, you know, one age group would be located. So this comprises, you know, is the single largest group of those with HIV per age. But if you combine it with these 25 to about 45 years of age, those 2 decades comprise of about 50% of those who are infected. So we know what age group is at most risk for HIV. They are the ones that are carrying a bulk of the percentage of HIV. Now, what we don't always recognize is that, you know, on this pie chart, at the cross-sectional sample of 43,000, greater than 55 years is 9%. But if you look at just the age range, you know, 55 to our natural lifespan here in the U.S. is, I think, 87.2 years of life. But HIV age, we'll later show some slides, that it's about 10 to 15 years off of that. That's what we call bimodal distribution. It may not look that big on this pie graph, but the bigger, the other kind of distribution by age is actually the senior population. Now, how do we break it down per risk factors on the pie chart? So male-to-male sexual contact, so anal receptive, is by far the largest and most at-risk population for HIV. It is the most infectious way to transmit HIV infection, and they make up 67% of those that are infected with HIV. 17% is heterosexual contact, so vaginal receptive intercourse is the second highest, and we kind of know that. Now, if we break it down, injection drug use, these two blue ones are a significant portion, and they're only 6%, but by itself, it is, you know, still a significant portion that we see. And you've got to consider that a lot of these people are at risk for hepatitis C, more so than these, because hepatitis C is more readily transmitted through injection drug use than sexual transmission, although it's still possible. Now, if we break it down per population, and this is where we start to recognize that there's still a lot of health disparities. In the U.S., one of the richest countries in the world, we still have such a sharp health disparity at the racial ethnicity lines. So who makes up the largest proportion, the single largest proportion of those infected with HIV per race and ethnicity? It's the Black and African American population. And you can tell that this has remained pretty much the same through time. And if we bring it back all the way to the 90s, it's still going to be a bulk of the infections. White is the second, and then we have later on the other minority, Hispanic, Latino, and then the other different races there are fairly low. They're barely registering. So if we look at the rate, incidence rate of infection, if you look here, this is a stark contrast. 19.4, that's the incidence rate compared to, let's say, the white population, 2.5, or the American Indian, 2.8. Hispanic Latino is also quite high, but this is very disproportionate. So this is what we call overrepresentation of an ethnicity or race that it's at risk. They are particularly at risk for HIV/AIDS infection. Now, I like this map because it shows us kind of how behind we're doing in the state of Florida. And many of you know the state of healthcare and how we run it here in the state of Florida. It's not the best. So here you can see that this is a little bit outdated. This is, you know, data up until about 2013. I can tell you that this actually, if it could get darker, Florida is darker as of the last 2 years. So here, if we look at the rates per population of 100,000, so that's your denominator, 606 here in the state of Florida by 2013. The other dark red state is New York. And so these two states at that time are number one and two for population living with HIV here in the U.S. The rates of infection are highest in our two states, Florida and New York. Now, in the last year, Florida actually overtook New York City, or New York. So it's always New York and Florida, we're always competing for first and second place, and that's not necessarily the, you know, a good proud status to have, but we're always competing. So the Southeast states in this past about 6 months, there's another publication showing that Southeastern states, MSM, male, are particularly at very high risk for infection. And so if you take, you know, that makes sense. MSM, male, is the highest risk as far as the risk factor, the gender, and the region of the states, of the country, this is the highest concentration. Now, if you look at classified as AIDS stages, so these are not just people living with HIV, but they have HIV and they're doing poorly. As in, their HIV and their CD4 count has progressed to where they are immunocompromised and need a lot of care, which is very expensive. Again, New York and Florida are proud to be number one and two. And again, this is always going back and forth. Every 1 or 2 years, we trade places with New York, or New York takes us as one and two. What I didn't put on this slide is that if you look at South Florida, considering West Palm Beach, Broward, and New York City, Miami-Dade County, if you just take that area and say that that's a state, it would rank number six in the entire country out of all 50 states if it was just a state itself. So let's look at specifically what we're talking about here in the state of Florida. What's the current status and how has it changed over time? So this is straight from the Department of Health page. And I kind of, you know, manipulated it so it's not so busy. But newly diagnosed HIV infections 2014, about 6,000. That's first in the nation in 2013, up to 17% from 2013 in Florida. Newly diagnosed AIDS cases in 2014. So that is, it was first in the nation in 2013 and up 21% from 2013 as of 2014. Pediatric AIDS, and that's really, really sad. We really shouldn't have any more of those happen. Now, if we have those that attain at 15 or 16 years of age, that's really sad enough. That means our prevention is not doing what it should. But what's worse is some of these are from vertical transmission. So that's really, really inappropriate. That's something that should never happen. It should not happen in this modern age. We have plenty of good treatment options to prevent vertical transmission from a serodiscordant couple or in a mother that has positive HIV and is pregnant. This should not happen. And yet we're second in the nation in 2013. Now, I'm not a pediatrician, or I don't practice, you know, infectious disease in pediatric age group, but this is a really, really sad number. Persons diagnosed living with HIV were third in the nation as of 2013. And the prevalence, again, we're pretty high. And again, about 13% of us in the nation are unaware that we're infected with HIV. So those are some pretty striking numbers. And I just want to show you that, look, South Florida is bad, but at least we're not the worst out of the Tri-County area. So, you know, Miami-Dade being so populated and so dense, it is the bulk of HIV here in the state of Florida. They carry the most infections, and the Ryan White public health sector that manages HIV patients without insurance is actually very, very robust. But and in Broward, we're second. But I can tell you that although a large percentage of patients with HIV/AIDS end up getting care at the Ryan White facilities and the public health sector, there is not enough funding and resources to manage the bulk of the infection. It's overwhelming. So no matter how good that infrastructure is, it's not going to match this concentration of HIV/AIDS. Again, we're here. And we're not so bad, but, you know, compared to the rest of the states, this is a sad number because this is not just HIV. These are people living with AIDS. So, you know, prevention may be one thing. But progression of HIV into AIDS is something that, again, in modern age, should not happen. That happens because of one of several things. Number one, we treat them, but we're not treating them well, or they're not sticking with the care, as in they're not taking the medicines, coming to care. Or number two, we're not diagnosing them in time. Remember, 12.8% are unaware. So by the time they show up, maybe they're sick, they're not feeling well, and we catch them then, they're already in the level of AIDS and they're symptomatic. That shouldn't happen nowadays. We have so many good medications that could prevent the progression of HIV into AIDS. But here we are, the Tri-County area, we are, you know, we're the three worst areas. Well, I guess not the third worst, but we are, you know, somewhat the worst areas here in South Florida, in the state of Florida. And the state of Florida is ranked, what, number one or number two, depending upon what year you're looking at it. Okay, so this is some good news, though. All right, so where's our trend in AIDS cases and rates? Well, we're getting better at it. So if we look at 2005 all the way through to 2014, we've had a pretty steady, you know, solid progression into, you know, controlling a little bit better. Now, this spike here, you'll say, well, what happened in 2012 to 13? That's more of testing. We changed some of the paradigms and how we tested and what we defined as those that were exposed and all that. So the county basically got better, and our denominator got better. And so we defined more. And so that's not that we suddenly did poorly here. It's just that our testing got better and our numbers got a little more accurate. So, but overall, we've gotten better at controlling HIV to AIDS. All right, so this is a very busy slide, and I wanted to walk you through this because I think it's very important to understand how we're represented. This pie chart in the middle is the state of Florida and a distribution of ethnicities or races ethnicities. So in the state of Florida, there's estimated 16 million people living here. A lot of people want to come to the beach. So the white population is 59% in the state of Florida, 14% are black, 23% are Hispanic, and 4% are other. Now, if you remember the national figures, the Hispanic population did overtake the black population as on minorities, as in I think the Hispanic population has reached about 27%, and now the black population about 25 to 26%. So in the last census, the Hispanic population is now overtaken the black population at the U.S. country level. Here, you can clearly tell we have a large bulk of Hispanic populations here in the state of Florida. Now, if we look at their distribution of HIV or AIDS, and let's just take HIV, in a cohort section of 6,000 sampled, the cross-sectional, what is the ethnicity and race percentage represented in those with HIV? Well, 31% of those with HIV are white. 41% of those with HIV in the state of Florida are black. 26% are Hispanic. AIDS, real similar. And so the point is that this is what we call overrepresentation. The black population represents 41% of those with HIV, although in the state of Florida only represents 14%. Same thing with AIDS, 52%. Now, Hispanic, they're a little bit better, but they're overrepresented in those who have HIV. So it's not proportional. If it was evenly distributed through the population, you should have the same percentage of those that are represented in the state. It should be divided in the same percentages at those at our state population or national level, but it's not. And even if we were to take national numbers, the black population, remember, that's about 25 or 26%. We're at 41%. At the national level, it's close to that as well. I mean, this is really a health disparity that we have to be aware of. Okay. So how have we gotten with testing? So the good thing is that we've gotten better at testing. In 2006 is when some of the guidelines changed with the CDC, and you get the sharp slope right here. And the percentage of positivity, it looks like it's better, but that's just because we're testing more. But this is a good slide, in fact, that we're making progress at testing. Now, what are some of the barriers, right? What's stopping people from getting tested? What's stopping people from getting HIV care and doing well? These are some of the proposed and hypothesized. A lot of these have been researched. The amount of HIV already in the community that exists, and you can measure that by a novel principle called the community viral load. Late diagnosis of HIV or AIDS, that's probably a bulk of it. Access to acceptance of care, stigma, denial, believe it or not, that's still a big problem. Discrimination, homophobia, HIV, AIDS, complacency. And actually, in a lot of the patients I've had in my last practice, I've had a lot of people come in and they were not concerned about their HIV, AIDS because they had so many friends that were getting better or stable, they just didn't worry about it as much. So that's kind of like a opposite or paradoxical phenomenon that we're seeing nowadays in the age of ARTs. And then poverty and unemployment, which is probably under-recognized. So I wanted to give you some updates on the 2016 CROI, or Conference of the Retrovirus, that happens every year. And this year it happened in Boston. And I found a couple slides that were, or a couple posters or reports that were quite interesting. So this group, they wanted to estimate the lifetime risk of a diagnosis of HIV infection in the U.S. Now, it was an abstract, so I didn't get to know it as far as how they did it very well. But the general U.S. population, the CDC calculated lifetime risk of infection to be 1 in 64, right? Black, 1 in 20. So that's very, very stark contrast. Hispanic, 1 in 48. Hawaiian Pacific Islander, 1 in 82. And then everybody else is well over 100. So down here, these are the drivers for, you know, less of an incidence rate. And black is such a high, you know, risk population for getting it. Here we break it down by the transmission risk factors, MSM being the highest, IV drug use being the second highest or one of the significant ones. And if we see here, the race distribution ends up being real similar. So who knows what the HIV screening guidelines are? I could pimp one of the residents and put them on the spot, but this is not the same as doing conference. But, you know, they're the publication that came out in 2006 kind of made it very, very obvious. Look, HIV/AIDS is a bad epidemic. This is 10 years after 1996, which is the era of HART. We say the post-HART era is when HIV should be considered controlled. The epidemic should be controlled. But we're far from it. And so the CDC said, look, what we're doing is not working. We've got to change how we do things. If you're going to have to ask every patient, can I check your HIV/AIDS status, and get their consent, you're going to invite, you know, a little bit of stigma, extra paperwork, and we know how that all that goes with pre-authorizations and all these other things. You have people fall through the cracks. So in 2006, they said opt-out is the policy. Those that enter care should get screened no matter what. And they even put an age, I mean, as far as 13 to 64, right? They should all get screened in all healthcare settings. There's not a healthcare setting where you shouldn't or you're not recommended to screen. And a written consent is not necessary. It should be in your general consent to treatment. So when somebody hits the ED, when they sign a general consent to do stuff, you have a little box that says, I opt out, as in, I don't want HIV screening. But it's not the same as you sign something saying that, okay, you can take this. Prevention counseling should not be required. And that was another problem that a lot of facilities were dealing with, because they're saying, if you're going to test it, you have to have somebody be able to screen and counsel this patient and its requirement. Now, that's good. It's not a bad thing. But you shouldn't forego testing just because you can't provide that, right? So they made this pretty solid. Did it work? Well, if we look at some of the numbers here that they've done in a study by the CDC, the non-Hispanic black population, uninsured and no health care in the last year, they benefited. Pre-2006, right? 03 to 06, pre-CDC guidelines versus 07 to 10, post-CDC recommendations. I didn't put the p-values, but these were significant. The male population, 41% got screened more often. 64% that were seen in the ED or in healthcare settings, they got screened. 45% as opposed to 38. So these are our at-risk groups. It works for them. All right, so there's another study that looked at just ED visits, right? If we just take a cross-section of ED visits, which a bulk of the patients go to, and this was done at Rush University, control versus Rush, so the before the guidelines, after the implementation of opt-out, you can see that there is a difference in how they represented. Before ED visit, after ED visit, right? Black is before they came to ED, and this is after they came to the ED, and how they're being being screened. And so the control is without opt-out. The Rush is with opt-out. And you can see that as far as after ED, you get an 8% increase here in engaged in care. Retained in care, those that were screened, 43 to 47%. They got screened with HIV, retained in care, right? There's a difference. There's an increase. And viral load suppression, that made a difference as well. So it's not just for screening, but also for all the outcomes of how they do in HIV care. So opt-out screening works if you do it. And in the ED, which is, you know, a very chaotic place to do kind of screening and all that, it made an impact. So one of my colleagues did a web-based evaluation on physician knowledge about the CDC's HIV screening. So how are we doing as far as awareness of this? Well, they were asked, you know, what areas, in what settings should you do the screening? They were asked several questions about the screening principles that the CDC published. And if they were asked, all patients in the following settings and areas of high undiagnosed HIV prevalence should be routinely tested, yes or no, prenatal care settings, 93%. That's pretty good. It's an A, right? So, but that's, you know, we all kind of know that. In prenatal settings, you should all test for HIV. Primary care practices for adolescents, 54%. So 46 or 45% felt like adolescents were not at risk for HIV. Primary care practice for adults, 76%. 24% felt like, you know, in routine settings for adult care, it's not indicated. Emergency departments, that's better, but 20% felt like, well, it's not necessary to test for HIV here routinely. Hospital inpatient wards, I don't understand that number. If you're admitted for something, especially for pneumonia, how could you not test for HIV? 66% said yes. That means around 43% felt like it wasn't necessary to test for HIV. Now, it didn't stratify it per the diagnosis. And then STI clinics, well, of course, right? That's a high number, 97%. So how does late entry affect care? So if you're not testing, what's going to happen is that you're going to progress to AIDS, right? If you progress to AIDS, that means you're late entry into care. If you progress to AIDS and caught, what happens? Well, this is basically the kind of like a reverse Kaplan-Meier curve. This is cumulative mortality, and that's your y-axis, and the x-axis is years from the start of ART. So once you start medicines, depending on what your CD4 count is, 049 being the lowest level, that's the, you know, the most severe AIDS level, up until 500 plus, which is the highest, it's pretty obvious that, you know, the later you start ARTs, or later you catch somebody in care, the further they are in AIDS, the worse they do. And, you know, I didn't put p-values, but it's very obvious that between 500, which is the best shape that you can be in, well, not the best shape, but at the time of this, at the time of the studies back of the cumulative data. Now, this is published in 2016, but this is numbers all the way from 2009 and before. They used to use 350 and 500 as a cutoff for starting ARTs. If you caught somebody at 500, the cumulative risk was almost, you know, a fraction of the risk for mortality over time compared to those that started in AIDS. So you don't want to wait until they're in AIDS. Just because they're in AIDS and you start them on medicine doesn't mean they're going to do well. The high CD4 count you can get for somebody with starting out at 50 may not be more than 100 or 150. So they're perpetually in AIDS for, you know, maybe a decade or more. So how does the racial ethnicity disparities, how do they drive missed clinic visits? because missed clinic visits are related to late start and AIDS progression. Well, again, real busy slide. I'm just going to point out here the black and the white population. And with more no-shows, so each quarter, so 3 months, 3 months, 3 months, 3 months makes a year, right? If they have a detectable percent of the viral load in each of these quarters, if they missed more visits for each quarter, you have an increase in viral load, and the black increases faster than the white. So the more visits you missed, it's not even in how it affects these to progress in viral load. So they keep going up in viral load, but there's a difference between the white and black population. You can see it here as well. So the percent of those with a controlled viral load suppression, again, black, white, right? And the more visits you miss, for some reason, the black population tends to be more affected. So if we look at it at another study, what are some of the predictors, right? Independent predictors in a multivariate analysis. I don't want to look at another curve. What's the independent predictor? Hispanic or non-Hispanic, 0.81, 0.79 for odds of virological failure. If you look at patients, right? Or if you look at patients with the no-show count. So this one is just patients in the clinic. What are the odds of a virological failure? Ethnicity being Hispanic or non-Hispanic. Hispanic was protective for some reason. Here, even more protective if you count no-show. Black was deleterious. So that was an independent predictor for virological failure. So a study that I did, because I was interested, especially here in South Florida with our documented, undocumented population, one would infer that being undocumented puts you at higher risk because you can't get access to the clinics, the sources, you can't get insurance. Well, yes, in some cases, the undocumented Hispanic population here, it was determined by an algorithm that was really complicated with the Social Security office that they no longer use. They did arrive later in care, and that translates as to lower CD4 count. So if we use a reference, undocumented Hispanic, 132 was their median CD4 count. That's AIDS level. And you compare it to documented Hispanic arriving at 166, black, 226, and white, 264. They were all significantly different. So the Hispanic population did arrive later, but the undocumented Hispanic population arrived even later than that. And the black population came pretty close to AIDS, but they weren't necessarily in AIDS level, right? At least not the median number. But what's interesting is what happens. Who's showing up to the appointments? This is where you would think the undocumented would not have a good outcome. They actually, for some reason, looked at, if we look at showing up 4 out of 4 quarters, some of them, or not at all, they had the highest amount, or next to the highest amount of those that showed up at all of their appointments, 4 out of 4 quarters. The Hispanic documented had the most, but this is not really that different. But if you look at what happens with the black population, a bulk of them showed up some of the time, and a lot fewer showed up all of their appointments. White population, real similar. Now, this is even more interesting. So given they arrived in care later, who got their viral load suppressed quicker? By 1 year, who is controlling their HIV? Then documented Hispanics were the highest percent of those that actually got the viral load controlled. So they showed up, so that denominator is not lower, because they were showing up to care. So these got counted. But for those that entered care, despite being documented, they were illegal alien, basically, they actually suppressed their viral load by 1 year. And the black population did worse. So there's a lot of questions that arise. And, you know, this raises more questions than answers. We don't know what's driving that. There may be cultural context. There may be infrastructural context. There may be, you know, pure, you know, racism, perhaps, at the provider level, at the hospital infrastructure level, at the patient community level. We don't know. But this is purely, you know, this is very, very bizarre. But this is a social dynamic. And after this study, there's been several that have shown that the undocumented don't necessarily do worse. And the foreign-born actually do better in many aspects, not just in HIV. Now, if we look at care engagement, so not only do they just link, but they continue to get care, the less quarters that they come, the higher chance that you're going to die, basically. If you look at, if you come to all of your appointments, you almost have twice the chance of dying if you miss most of your appointments. And this translates to, CD4 count as well. So if you start at AIDS level, it's even worse. This is really a very, very striking graph. If you started, depending on your CD4 count, and you took medicines most of the time versus less than 75% of the time, and this is a hard number we use, you have to take your medicines all the time, at least at 75% of the time. If you're at AIDS level, look how steep the curve is if you don't take your medicines. You die so much quicker. You don't survive. Now, if you're above AIDS level, there's a little bit of a cushion. But if you get into care late and you don't take your medicines, you know, this is a very, very, you know, this is, you progress very quickly. So I'm only going to go over one of the many aspects as to why we have problems or barriers to care. And this is a little bit dated, but this is by far my favorite study because it still holds true. Competing assistance needs. This is when some of your patients may say, you know, I couldn't come to care because I had to pay for my kid's school or I had to buy food for my family. These are routine basic necessities. And William Cunningham did a study with the Hyksos data in 1996 and 97. That's a big national database of healthcare costs and quality of care and related to HIV. And they showed that when they did a prospective interview of about 3,000 patients, 33% said that they that visited an ED visit in the past 6 months, and one-third of people with each barrier go to the ED for access to care. About 33% of these that said that I had a barrier ended up in the ED, right? When you talk to them, 33% said they needed to use the money for food and clothing and housing. 35% lacked transportation. 40% felt too sick to go to the doctor. They were so sick that they couldn't drag themselves to an office appointment and wait in the waiting room. Somebody had to drag them to the ED. And then 38%, they actually gave up food. They had to forego food, clothing, and other necessities just to get medical care, right? So this is a driver. Financial barriers and the survival impact. So if we look at low income versus high income, the probability of survival is less and less through time. So with that being said, that's kind of our epidemiology. Everybody still awake, kind of? So let's talk about what's killing them, right? So back in 1996, in the pre-ART era, we all know that PCP and other overwhelming septic infections and pneumonia are probably the number one killers of HIV/AIDS. What are the common causes nowadays? Well, let's look at the life expectancy first. So this is also from CORAY from 2016 as well. It's real interesting. They wanted to look at how long they're living now. You know, what's the average lifespan of patients with HIV? Now, it's hard to do that, but so they had to do a mathematical model based off of a cohort that was by Kaiser Permanente in California. And they have a huge state database where they can look up their death certificates, social security numbers. And so they're able to get a robust sample to look at it. The patient data spanned from 96 to 2011. So we get a pretty good sample that's, you know, almost 20 years of information. And what we found is that if you calculated it and matched it with a mathematical model and simulated it, age 20, so if you have HIV and you're age 20, the 1996 to 2006 data shows that you had an additional 36 plus years of life if you had HIV, whereas if you're HIV negative, you have 62.3, which is, you know, pretty close to what we're getting as far as our average lifespan here in the United States. The gap is 26. So if you have HIV, you were robbed of about 26 years of life. And that's 96 to 2006. Nowadays, 2007 and 11, you had another 49 years or so. And this remains the same. And so the gap is a lot less. It's about half. So we're doing better as far as keeping our people with HIV alive, right? You have to be in care and all that. But this doesn't account for that. This is just across the board. So people doing poorly to people doing well. So what is killing them? So we look at the drug acute, DAD, I've always wondered what that meant. It's like drug and adverse effect database. It's nationally collected. And so if we look at that cohort database based off of 99 to 11, 2011, and this is about 4,000 people sampled, age-related death is still the majority. 29% are still being reported to have died from HIV-AIDS-related problems. Now, liver-related, that's really increased. It's 13%, and that's because we're unmasking those with hepatitis C now. Liver failure, 2%. Cardiovascular disease is on a sharp increase. As they're living longer, things that affect everybody else are affecting them as well. Non-AIDS cancers, that's on the increase. So, you know, people with HIV, if they live longer, they're still at risk for colon cancer. They're still at risk for cervical cancer. In fact, they're at high risk for all the cancers. And other unknown, and I just wanted to put up here that I can't believe, but suicide is still 4% of the population that are dying. And invasive bacterial infection, only 7%. So how does this look on a curve if you take the entire cohort? Age-related, yes, looks high, but it's coming down, right? So it's decreasing in the percentage of people it's killing. However, the virally suppressed, so this is everybody, including those that have AIDS and are dying from AIDS. This is a slide based off of those that if you control their HIV, AIDS is not as much of a factor. It's this line down here. What's the highest is the others, you know, the unknown stuff, right? Which is, you know, really an artificially inflated number because it's a mixed bag of a lot of things. But this little light-colored plus blue, non-AIDS cancers. The next one down, cardiovascular-related death. So the non-AIDS cancer, so colon cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, those things, cervical cancer, they're claiming the lives of HIV patients are well controlled. And cardiovascular disease. And this is a really good curve showing that the ratio of cardiovascular disease related to AIDS-related death then increases with time and the age of death. So cardiovascular disease is becoming a very strong driver in mortality and morbidity in HIV. So, you know, I'm not going to go into it, but there are studies looking at proposing that HIV should be considered as a risk factor on the Framingham risk score. There's a lot of inflammation that occurs with HIV. So how do you prevent it? What's recommended? We can go into the guidelines, but it's just, there's a formulation. Truvada basically is recommended. What's important is who it's recommended for. You want to do it to prevent patients that are adult men who have sex with men, so they're at substantial risk of acquisition. Heterosexually active men and women who are at substantial risk of HIV transmission, and IV drug users. So if you had these three that are at significant risk, and I would say that if you have an IV drug use patient, whether they're at substantial risk or not, more than just IV drug use, I would prophylax them. MSM, monogamous couple, you know, maybe not, but poly, if they have polygamous relationships, then you probably should. So the only caveat is that uninfected heterosexual active individuals whose partners are HIV infected, serodiscordant couples, as one option to protect the uninfected in the patient or conception. So those that are serodiscordant, like their partners, positive and they're negative, you need to have that conversation with them. There is benefit in protecting them. It's not recommended as solidly as a 2B. I'm sorry for the pediatricians, adolescents. There's not enough data to significantly say anything as far as where the CDC goes. All right, so does it work? Well, I'm going to point out two studies real quickly. If we give the recommended regimen, which is either tenofovir or a combo of tenofovir plus something else, and we give it as a pill for people to take, this was done in, Baton. So this was, this was done in Africa. So if you gave these populations this and they were at high risk or in heterosexual discordant couples, this is effective placebo, didn't really protect you. It halved it. So taking prophylaxis, which is every day, does work at preventing transmission. Now, if we look at this, pre-exposure HIV prevention in men with sex with men, this is done in the New England, Philadelphia area. If they take Truvada every day, and this is the highest risk group. Yes, there's more infection, but again, there's a big difference in placebo versus giving PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. So if they're taking Truvada every day, you can really decrease the transmission. It's not zero, but you can significantly decrease the transmission rate. So there is a new product that's going to come out soon called dapivirine, and that's like a vaginal ring. So it gives something local, but it's absorbed just like the Ortho Evra ring that you can get. And they looked at the how it affects, you know, prevention or how it prevents transmission. And this was done in Aspire. I think that's an African cohort. I think IPM is a multi-center cohort. And what it's shown is that it does have an efficacy of about 27%. And in the 15 sites, 13 sites, 37% here. Among women older than 21 years, again, they will say in that study that it's not known under 21 years of age. So how about treatment? What are the indications now? How do we treat it? What's out now? So, you know, not everybody's going to treat HIV here. But to be able to recognize who should be on treatment, then you can better, you know, situate your patient. And it used to be that, oh, well, if they have a certain CD4 number, then we can treat. Well, that's out the door. It's recommended that all patients with HIV, once you become infected and you're proven to be infected, you should be in treatment, regardless of whatever your CD4 count is. ART is also recommended for HIV infected individuals to prevent HIV transmission. So you need to treat it to make them better and also to prevent transmission. Okay? Treatment for prevention. What's important is that when you initiate ARTs, you got to address strategies to optimize adherence. This is trying to get at, you know, well, I'm going to prescribe it for you, and then I don't know if you're going to come back or you're going to take it every day. They have to be ready, and you can actually, and I've done this, delay care if they're not ready. And I've had patients that I've delayed and delayed care because I knew if I started it, they were kind of wishy-washy, that I would create resistance because they're only taking it half the time or part of the time. And some have frankly told me I don't want to start it. And the CDC made this recommendation based off what? The Prano and START studies. And basically what they show is a 50% reduction of morbidity and mortality. So when we started treating it at any level, and they said, you know, if we started it immediately rather than delaying under 500, which is the 2009 guidelines, they said, well, wait until 500. Did you say 350? It went to 500 in 2009. In 2012, they started recommending, well, we think at any level. It became much more solid this past year because of Temprano and START. And this is a busy chart, but I just want to I'm going to walk you through what this means. If you deferred ARTs and you had early ARTs, now we're not going to do this, isoniazid it, because this is a South African study. It showed that there may be some advantage if you put isoniazid it, but let's say that deferred ARTs versus early ARTs, if you deferred it, you had a 12.4% probability of of death. Right, in early ART, 6.9. So it decreased your mortality. And so these are the blue and the gray. It's like half. Just starting ARTs on time. The START trial, so this is South African study, Temprano. The START trial is multinational. It's by the Insight START group. And it's a collaboration that's ongoing, it's still ongoing. But they published data this last year on what they have so far. And again, it's the same thing that we're seeing that when you defer initiation, now they did use 350, and it's because they started this study pre-2009, so they were still using 350. If you started at 350 or above, then you had a lesser chance of accumulating first primary event or something with AIDS or HIV-related event. And if you deferred it, so you waited till 350, you're almost twice as much in probability of getting an AIDS-related HIV event. There's a lot of medications. This is just a little picture of all the options that we have, okay? And there are some combinations here. And so literally, this is the day and age that Joe Aaron, if you guys know him, he says that this is the age of integrase inhibitors and one tablet pills. And that's so true. These are the options that you can give one tab once a day, and they have your full combo in it, okay? So we have a lot of options. So there are different mechanisms, right? So as you know, when HIV comes in, it needs to fuse, and so you have to have a co-receptor that attaches and fuses the cell, and you can stop them here, you can stop them there. When they try to translate their RNA into your DNA and integrate it into your body, because that's what HIV does, it becomes part of your genetics. NRTIs and NNRTIs and intercalate, they mess it up, you know, they do it there. Your integrase inhibitors, and this is the integrase inhibitors age or era right now. This is our most effective medicines. Right here, these are anchors. they affect it at the nucleolar level. And in the nucleus, they can't integrate and form DNA and then reverse back into RNA to be able to transcribe the proteins, translate. And then here, the protease inhibitors, when they're in the cell, they, you know, you have to cleave your proteins and peptides into something functional. That's what the protease inhibitors do. And this is here and here is all they had in the 1990s. Before 1996, all they had was this. And we know that we have to have three agents, at least two steps to stop it. And because HIV, and I'll get made fun of by my program directors, but HIV is a very, it has low fidelity. It's a very promiscuous virus because it keeps forming mutations. The DNA polymerase is so inaccurate, but that means that there's more mutations. Now, what is the recommended regimen? Three agents. You have to have a backbone, which is, you know, they don't use these terms, backbone and anchor anymore, but for understanding it, I still like to use it. You have to have two NRTIs. Now, that's not biblical anymore. It's not scripture anymore, but it's still the mainstay, and it's still recommended. The anchor is one of something else, right? So this is like AZT and, say, lamivudine or something here, right? And then one of something else. So if you see patients in your practice or encounter them and they're on one pill, make sure it's a combo pill. If they're on two pills, make sure one of them is combo. Because if they're not on three agents or four, because some need a booster, they're not taking adequate regimen. It's not accurate. And in fact, if you admit somebody and you only put them on one of the agents, please don't do that. Just put them on nothing. It's better than putting them on part of an agent. If you're not sure what their HIV regimen is, just don't start any of that and consult your HIV or ID group so that they can weigh in, because it's the worst thing to do is admit somebody and then put them on Truvada by itself. Truvada should be with something else. So these are the recommended medications. And I'm not going to read through these because it's probably Greek to a lot of you guys. But there's a lot of options that are first-line recommendations. Look how many options there are. And a lot of these are just once-a-day pills. It's very easy to treat once a day, low side effects. Some of them, in the past, we used to have a tripla as a first-line recommendation. Surreal dreams, somnolence, that is not the first-line treatment anymore. A lot of these have very, very little side effects. You can still have the maldistribution of your fat, pads, and all that. But as far as like liver toxicity, is not as bad as it used to be. The side effects of somnolence is not as bad. Diarrhea, we're not using PIs like we used to. They're very well tolerated. These are your fixed combination tabs, right? Now, I got this off of a European page, so it's Complera, not Eviplera here. We call it Complera in the States. Don't use that, by the way. It's not so good. So what's in the pipeline? Novel agents in the pipeline. Well, I don't know very much of these because these are, you know, just from posters and abstracts and in a webcast. So there are new, the integrase inhibitors, which is at the nucleolus DNA level. And this is what we call nanosuspension. Sounds like I'm in a sci-fi movie. It's like nanotech. But cabotegravir, nanosuspensions, ion injections, and what that means is that they make it into crystals, and the crystals are kind of serrated to where there's a lot of surface area on it. And so they can be crystallized, which means that it's a long-term release, but there's a lot of surface area, which means that there's a lot of medication getting into your bloodstream. GS9883 is just another tab, integrase inhibitor. In NRTIs, we have those, doravirine. And it's a new agent that's coming out, nanosuspension of ropivirine, which is the agent I said that is not so good. This is really cool. What are some novel approaches? So are we tackling HIV in a different fashion? So there's potentially a new agent. So a chain along the replication cycle, NRTTI. Now, it's like an NRTI. Basically, what does an NRTI do? You're making the RNA is being transcribed in DNA, and then use an NRTI, and it's an analog, so it just goes into DNA where it's not supposed to, and it messes things up. It acts like it hides into the DNA, and it acts like it's supposed to be part of that DNA. Well, this one not only does that, because it's an NRTI, but it also stops the reverse transcriptase, that polymerase, from moving along a chain. So it doesn't just intercalate, but it stops the whole process. So EFDA is being looked at right now. I think it's in phase 2 trials. Maturation inhibitors. So that's a whole new process. So if you recall where the protease inhibitors, once the virus goes into your cell, takes over your machines, makes peptides and proteins. Those proteins need to be cleaved. Now, those are called protease inhibitors in the 90s, like Kaletra. And what they do is they bind to those little cleavage proteins. So the proteases can't do their action. This is a novel agent in that it doesn't attach to the protease. It attaches to the cleavage sites of the transcribed DNA. So it actually, to the produced protein, the peptide. So it doesn't allow you to attach. So that's just another pathway and attachment inhibitor. And this is another one at entry. So when HIV tries to attach to the CD4 cell, it needs a lot of gateway proteins, GP34, GP24, GP120. And you have the co-receptors, CCR5 or CXCR4. This one here attaches to the GP120. And this is the only agent that we have that attaches to this protein. Now, we don't know how promising that is, but that's a new agent that could be potentially produced to attack HIV at another pathway that it replicates in your cells. So, all right, I know it's been kind of long, and I just want to summarize that overall, the incidence of HIV/AIDS is decreasing, but the population of HIV-1 infected people, it continues to grow, as you've seen. There is a lot of racial ethnic minorities overrepresented in the HIV-infected population. There's a lot of health disparities still. Late entry into care is bad, and they do bad, and they die earlier. Non-AIDS-related causes of mortality, they're on the rise. It's not just AIDS killing these patients anymore. That is still the highest killer if you consider everybody, including those living with AIDS. But if you consider those that are well-controlled, these patients are living long enough to die from cardiovascular disease, other cancers. Certain medications have been approved for PrEP, and you got to know how to use them, and you got to be aware that these patients are candidates for it. So if you don't do it yourself, you can refer them to somebody that can, and be very, very free to do that. Be very liberal in doing that. Start ART early reduces morbidity and mortality. That makes a lot of sense, but people, we're still having a hard time doing that. There is a broad armamentum of effective antiviral medications to suppress HIV replication. Now, we don't have a cure yet, and I didn't know if I had time to mention, but there's one other study that's really riveting, and it was on my Twitter feed that I saw this, but if anybody's familiar with CRISPR, CRISPR is a genetic sequence that you can use to intercalate something into a genetic gene, into a genome. So if you wanted to adjust, like this person has the Delta F105 for CF, you can try to use that to bypass it. So you put a primer in that skips that, right? They've tried to put a primer using CRISPR to bypass DNA replication, the activation of the switch of HIV in mice cells. And they were able to suppress a bulk of the mice. I think, I want to say 60% of the mice's replication of HIV or the equivalent of HIV in mice. However, it ultimately failed because HIV knows how to escape. But that is a novel new regimen that I couldn't even get it onto the slides. It's so new. But CRISPR is a new kind of tool that we may be using. So there are novel approaches, including DNA manipulation, which is really the only cure, or broadly neutralizing antibodies. But there are new regimens coming out. All right. Well, I thank you for your attention, and I thank you for not falling asleep, at least most of you guys. And if you have any questions, let me know. And if you want to, I guess, a copy of this has been shared with you. Sure. Those are two really good questions. So the last cost analysis I'm aware of, and it has been done one more time, and I'm sorry I don't know this data, but the last one that I know of is by Dr. Gabo. And it was in 2009. It was done off of a national HIV and R database. It was very broad. It was done off of hospitalized and outpatient clinic patients. The median cost across the board was about $12,000 to $13,000 per patient. Of care. Now, that's considering if they get hospitalized and whatnot, ARTs. That's a median. Now, if you stratify that per CD4 count, if you had low CD4 count, such as 100, it went up to about $18,000 per year. If you were well-controlled, above 500, then you go down to about $8,000 per year per person. The ranges within that median went all the way up to $100-something thousand, but you know, those are some more of the outliers. But I would say the median cost nowadays, if you count inflation at 3%, is about $12,000 to $15,000 per patient per year. Care is getting cheaper, but complications are just differing, you know, from age-related to non-age-related. Now, the second question was regarding
DOT.
So there have been studies looking at DOT. It doesn't work the same in DOT with HIV as it does in TB. And the main reason is that a TB has a finite number of days. HIV/AIDS, they've looked at it, and the only ones they found to have credible benefit or sustainable processes are those that are homeless or ad hoc, as in they were discharged from a facility like a jail. Those two populations were noted to have some significant benefits from it, and those studies were real short, like a year or two, and that had sustainable costs. Other than that, DOT hasn't been fleshed out to be a sustainable option that has enough benefit as far as cost and everything else at the HIV broad level. Another question.
Yeah. Really appealing to me. I tend to treat a younger, less adherent population to a daily medication, also less well insured, who may not be able to get a daily Truvada. And so I think this was like one or two pills before, and of course, one or two pills after, and of course. But I'm a little reticent to change practice based on one study. Is it worth doing? Is it not ready for prime time?
My theory is that whenever you see something that's new, and it's something as far as, you know, if you match it to, you know, the effects of that versus what you're talking about, if it's something like, you know, hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia and diabetes, that's day-to-day fluctuation, and there's not long-term effects as far as like resistance at the social level, I'm more ready to change. But as far as HIV, if, you know, you do that, and it turns out that it's not as well understood, you've really changed societal resistance. And so I tend to, with PrEP, be real careful, and I select my patients. The only the studies before that one that really showed PrEP to work is if you take it every day, regardless of sex. The only ones that were on demand, as in before, were tenofovir gels. And the studies I know at the adult level were done in Africa, and those serodiscordant couples had about a 27 to 28% decrease in their transmission rate. But that was serodiscordant couples. Those were high risk for HIV women in Africa with unknown, you know, partners. And that showed with tenofovir gel, pre-coital and post-coital tenofovir gel, a decrease in HIV transmission. I didn't read that study word for word. I don't know it very well. I would be really hesitant to start something like that on demand. Those with PrEP really should be in the mindset that this is, if I'm with a partner or at risk, this should be more of a lifelong thing, or as far as when I'm at risk, rather than an off and on, because then you start to, you know, worry about adherence and or partial treatment. I don't know if that helps or not, but I would be really hesitant to do that. Yes, sir. So that's really interesting. That's another good question. In the last IDSA conference I went to, Dr. Gulick, Paul Sachs, and Joe Aaron had a kind of like a debate that they usually do. And the data so far is that anybody that's been controlled, HIV viral load suppressed or undetectable, there hasn't been a case of known transmission. So with that being said, the counterpart, and this is Robert Gulick's piece, is that he said, you know, with that being said, look, viral load can be detected, and it's been studied in semen of undetectable men. And they've done that in men about 3 years ago, an MSM population of men that were viral load undetectable in their serum. When they studied in PCR their semen, there was detectable virus. So because the transmission possibility is there, it's probably that they should be on PrEP, at least official recommendation. Practically speaking, you know, is it really, you know, are we talking about 0.01% or less than that? Probably so, because, again, for known HIV undetectable viral loads, there hasn't been a known case of transmission yet. Now, that hopefully I'm not wrong, isn't, you know, something recent coming out, but there really isn't that I know of yet.
And how often do patients
blood transfusions are pretty safe. Our assays are very good at detecting. If you looked at the studies there, they were using less than 400 viral load, but those are studies based off of like pre-2009 data. In fact, in 2009, they had an assay down to less than 50. In the last couple of years, less than 48, and now less than 20. And the assays for a viral load PCR go down to undetectable, so you can see in blood whether it's detectable or not. I would trust a blood transfusion. I would get one myself or my kid. If I needed one, I wouldn't be worried about that. I'd be more worried about hepatitis C, actually. Yes. It's the Florida statute. It's pure and simple law. The state of Florida's statutes still require permission. It has nothing to do with necessarily the hospitals. It's the Florida statute still recommends or still demands that patients get tested. And that's based off of, you know, in the 90s, insurances were changing, how they're taking care of patients. There's a lot of stigma. So, you know, the opt-out is recommended but not mandated at the federal level. CDC publishes it. I'm really, you know, angry that I live in a state that's really behind in that aspect. But you can't blame the hospitals necessarily. They're just following the laws.